Hi, it's great to be with you. As William said, my name is Kev Murdoch. I'm the minister of Euston Church. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this week of talks with you. Thank you for coming. I don't know about you, I'm still at the stage where it's just nice to get out of the house in the evening. So if you're here in the building, it's really good to be together. And welcome if you're online. I hope you're able to get a drink. I hope you're in front of a massive HD telly so that you can really feel part of things with us this evening. And I want to introduce you all to Leo and Siobhan, who we're going to be interviewing. Hi, guys. Welcome.
Hi, Kev.
Leo is, well, you were an investment banker at Schroders. You've just left there. And Siobhan, the last time we chatted, you were looking for a job, still looking?
Yep, still looking for a job in graphic design.
So anyone got any jobs in graphic design? Come speak to Siobhan at the end. These guys are part of the church family. They come here to St. Helen's Church. And they actually got married, they were telling me, right on this spot 2 years ago.
Yep, exactly 2 years ago.
Today's their wedding anniversary. Should we say happy anniversary?
Thank you.
So, Leo, this is your idea of a romantic evening.
Yeah. we'll try to do something after this. We watched a video of our wedding this morning, which is about as good a celebration as you can get in the lockdown era, isn't
yeah.
it? So there we go.
Well, we won't ask you where you're going later in case we're all tempted to come and sit at the next table. But what was it like? So this spot, do you remember much about it?
Yeah, it was a really amazing day. We had a really great time. Lots of friends and family. We're very grateful, actually.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And I guess, as we'll talk about tonight, there was kind of a lot of doubts about the wedding. We were going to get legally married one way or another, but whether that was going to be in hospital or just a small thing or here was pretty unknown until just a few weeks before. But yeah. Thankfully, it happens, and it was a wonderful day.
Do you remember what Siobhan looked like, what she was wearing?
Yeah, she looked pretty good. I mean, she always looks fantastic, obviously. I know that in wedding addresses, the joke, I think, is always to really, you know, compliment the bride and then just really insult the groom.
Be rude to the bloke.
Yeah, the way they did it, you know, the guy speaking said, Siobhan, you look, his exact words were, an absolute babe.
Yeah.
And he said, and Leo, you look about as good as you usually think you do. So that was that. But okay. A good day, nonetheless.
Well, fair enough. And these guys have kindly come to talk to us this evening about their experience of Siobhan's recent very serious illness. So thank you very much for coming and for being so open about that with us tonight. We need to rewind slightly, don't we? So before the wedding, you just got engaged, I think. And that was when you started to get ill, Siobhan. And it was all a bit undefined at the start.
Yeah, it was. So I was working full-time at a coffee shop at the time and just started to feel really tired. And I thought, you know, early shifts, I'm on my feet all day. That's probably it. And then, after a week or so, my feet actually started to swell up. And I thought, this is a bit unusual, probably nothing to worry about. A friend urged me to go to a walking centre and I went to a walking centre. They kind of brushed me off. Went to a couple of different walking clinics, and they kind of said, book a blood test with your GP, it's probably nothing to worry about. And so I wasn't that worried. Booked a blood test with my GP. The GP couldn't do that for about 4 weeks. And so I was like, cool, that's fine, I'll just wait until then. And in that time, it was New Year's Eve in 2018, and I woke up and the swelling had gone to my face. And by this point, I was a bit concerned that it would stop me from breathing and didn't really know what to do. And so then I phoned 111, and then they said, go straight to A&E. Finally did that. They finally did some tests and told me that my kidney function was at 13%.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was obviously quite shocking. We didn't really know what to do with that information. They immediately admitted me and said that there's an underlying disease that I had. They weren't quite sure what it was, but they wanted to do some further tests. And so, I was in hospital for a couple of weeks. They did their tests and found out that I have a rare blood disease called dense deposit disease, which causes my immune system to attack my kidneys. So that's what that's what they told me. It was, yeah, quite shocking. That was January 2019.
And just the speed of it, really, like,
yeah,
all of that kind of happened in the space of about 3 or 4 weeks, and going from just normal, a bit tired, to physically unrecognizable with the swelling, and then, just this diagnosis of, you know, this will be a lifelong battle.
So even at that stage, it's kind of life-changing thing.
Yeah.
How does that feel as you're gearing up for your wedding plans and things?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously you feel like the floor has given way beneath you.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of the sadness is we assumed we knew what life we were going to have. We were on the trajectory that most 20-somethings in the city were on. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly realizing in the space of a few weeks that actually that's not the life that God has chosen to give us. And actually, yeah, I think we mourned for that life, really. Yeah. And that was a great deal of the sadness. Mm-hmm.
Did you find, I mean, you're already talking about where's God in this, I guess. Did you find yourself able to pray in this phase?
Yeah, I think prayer was particularly helpful for me. After I got diagnosed, they kind of released me from hospital with a bunch of medications. And during that time, the medications actually made me really unwell. Mm-hmm. Just physically felt sick the whole time, which stopped me from eating. I could manage about a bowl of Cheerios a day, and that was it. Haven't eaten Cheerios since. It was a really, really scary time. I lost a whole bunch of weight, quite a dangerous amount of weight. And we didn't really know what was wrong because we thought it might be the kidney failure, didn't know what it was. Turns out it was the medication. But in that time, when I was stuck at home, not able to go anywhere because I was so unwell, in bed really just all the time, prayer was really, really helpful. And knowing that from the Bible, I can see that I have a God who loves me and a God who cares for me and a God who is good is so helpful. There's actually a book in the Bible called Psalms, and there's a whole bunch of people in there who, go through various things, but particularly a lot of faithful people who go through sadness and suffering, and they cry out to God, and they ask God, how long, O Lord? Like, why is this happening? And so it gave me real comfort in that I could do the same. I could pray to God and say, how long, O Lord? And I knew that I was praying to a God who cared and a God who was listening as well.
So you're really able to make those Psalms your own in this time.
Yeah, definitely.
So just on the timeline, so we're coming towards, obviously, May is when you were getting married. How did health things go in the run-in towards that?
Yeah, it was kind of okay. So I got readmitted to hospital in about April because I was so unwell. And they took me off my medication and kind of just said, we'll leave you off your medication for now. Go and enjoy your wedding. You'll be fine. After your wedding, we'll come back and chat about things and see how you are then. Mm-hmm. It took me off my medication. I felt a million times better. So, that's why the wedding was actually a really great day. because I was feeling so much better. Yeah, I did. It was, a lot better than I was.
So in terms of, I mean, for better, for worse, is one of the things you would have been saying, things looking slightly better at the wedding. And then you went on your honeymoon.
Yeah.
And that was fine. And then things changed quite quickly when you got back.
Yeah, we had a really nice time away. We went to Greece and it was really fun. I was feeling fine, but didn't actually know that my kidney function was rapidly declining again. I'll just pass over to Leo.
Yeah, so it was a couple of days after we got back from honeymoon. I woke in the middle of the night and Siobhan was having a seizure. Mm. So he rang the ambulance and they came very quickly. Were being taken to hospital and she had another seizure in the ambulance, and we got to A&E and similar story. Still with the seizing. Yeah, and it was pretty awful, actually. And they took Siobhan to the recovery room. I think that's what it's called. It's kind of A&E's last line of defence, as it were.
Okay, wow.
And they said, can you go sit in the family room?
Wow.
Yeah, I went to sit down in the room and, you know, you kind of think, I know what this room is because I've seen it on TV. This is the room where you sit and then they come in and tell you, you know, the bad news. So rang Siobhan's parents and family. Her parents came in from Hampshire straight away, and her sister and brother-in-law, they live in London, so they came up. And yeah, it was a terrible, terrible time. Thinking back to it, it's a blur, really. They do what doctors do and give you all of the caveats and say, you know, we can't make any guarantees. We don't really know how this is going to go. We can't say for certain she'll wake up, everything like that. That was bad. So there was a time during that where they spoke very seriously of brain damage, which is what they thought at first. Which thankfully, obviously, didn't come to fruition, praise God. But they did, once they managed to stabilise things, they put Siobhan into a coma and took her up to intensive care.
And how long was that phase going on in the coma?
I think she was in a coma for 3 or 4 days.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, before they wake her up. Yeah.
So what do you remember next after that, Siobhan?
Not very much. I remember going to bed the night before the seizures and then waking up a few days later in intensive care.
Yeah.
Not really understanding what had happened. It was my birthday that week, so that was was in intensive care for my 24th birthday, which is, it was fine. The nurse bought me a cake. That was very nice. but it was quite confusing. I don't really remember much of it, to be honest.
And is this the point where they moved you on to dialysis? Or that was the next step? So can you say what that is? I mean, I think people like me maybe don't even know what that is.
So dialysis is basically a machine that does what your kidneys are supposed to do.
Yeah.
So your kidneys clean your blood. And because my kidneys weren't doing that, they put me on dialysis. So they take all your blood out, put it through a machine and put it back in. And the process takes about 4 hours.
Wow.
And I had to do that 3 times a week. So, a life of hospital, So I was in, after intensive care, I was in hospital for about a month. While they tried to salvage my kidneys. But in that time, they just said the seizures kind of have just killed them, really. So then they torture us through dialysis. And it was kind of, they were having conversations about transplants as well. Dialysis.
How did you feel when that suddenly was on the cart?
They'd said right at the start that it was a possibility that at some point soon I'll have to have a kidney transplant. And realistically, because of my age, it's a good chance I'll have to have more than one in my life.
Okay.
So they tend to last, they say about 20 years, dependent on your situation.
Yeah.
So hopefully, or in theory, I would need more than one.
Yeah.
The dialysis was pretty rubbish. I know a lot of people cope quite well with it.
Okay.
But for me, it was just dialysis, home, sleep, back to dialysis, home, sleep. I was able to come to church at that point, which is great because I wasn't before. It was really hard. But with the transplants, I had quite a few people come forward, which is amazing.
So how does that work? I mean, how do they go about sorting the kidney?
Yeah, they basically just, you volunteer. So a person who says, I'd like to be a donor, sends a message to the hospital, says, I'd like to be a donor for this person.
Okay.
Can you start me, can I start being tested for it? My dad immediately, I think actually my dad from very start in January came forward and said, I'm going to be tested now just in case this needs to happen. And then we had, multiple church family members, other family come forward.
It sounds amazing. Like, it sounds like they almost did a shout out of anyone want to volunteer their kidney.
It was, the doctors were actually really shocked. I don't think they'd had a patient with so many volunteers before. Because a lot of people, I'm in a very privileged position because a lot of people are on the national waiting list and the average waiting time there is 2 years.
Wow.
And so I had, multiple people coming forward in the first few days saying, I'll give a kidney.
But your dad is the one who got picked. Why was that? Particularly good kidneys?
The doctors kind of made a comment saying, because you've got so many donors, we'd recommend you take the older ones first. It sounds a bit crude, but they said, take your older donors first so that later on in your life you can rally up those people again.
So are you one of these people?
Yeah, I'll probably be next in line. And thankfully, we've now got three nieces. So,
he's outsourced, six more he's outsourced out the there. Job already. There you go. So you're going in for this operation, massive operation.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking probably in the story, this is the point where anyone would be praying. You know, any of us who don't come to church or even know what's out there, we'd probably all pray at this point.
Yeah.
What difference does it make to be praying going into an operation like this when you know the person that you're praying to?
I think for me it does make a huge difference knowing that I'm praying to a God who understands. Jesus came to this earth and he died on the cross. He got crucified. He knows what it's like to suffer. He knows what it's like to lose friends. He lost friends and wept himself. And knowing that, in the hospital bed, totally out of control in this situation, that I'm praying to a God who knows exactly what I'm going through and a God who is actually in control of that as well.
Yeah.
It makes a massive difference, to me.
And for you as the husband, Leah?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And it shows how fickle my heart is, but I think this is true for anyone, that I probably never prayed more, actually, than that year. Those days in intensive care, what else can you do but plead with the Lord, really? One night where I was at home, it was early on in that intensive care time, and got a call to say Siobhan's lungs had collapsed.
Oh, wow.
Which I don't know if any of you are medics. It's not as serious as it sounds.
Okay.
But
In the context.
Of things, though. In the context, it was horrifying, actually. We have the privilege of being able to pray.
Yeah.
I can only imagine how hard and terrifying it would have to be if you didn't even have that, to be alone at home when your wife's in hospital. You've no idea what's going to happen. Yeah, it makes all the difference to be able to pray to a God who knows, as Siobhan said, who knows what it's like to suffer and to know what it's like to have friends die. It makes all the difference.
Now, you watched something the night. Tell them about what you watched the night before the operation.
Okay, so there was a show on Channel 5 a few years ago. I'm not really a Channel 5 watcher. But they basically had a series of three live surgeries. And one of them was a kidney transplant done by the surgeon doing Siobhan's transplant. And I thought I'd give it a watch the night before, before Siobhan had hers, which looking back was a very high-risk strategy to try and reassure myself. But thankfully, it really paid off.
Okay.
And I know that people often kind of crudely joke it's just like the plumbing inside.
Wow.
Honestly, it was just like the plumbing. It was, spare part, stitch it into the pipes and off it goes. So I slept relatively
easily.
These are
technical medical terms.
I probably shouldn't go. I won't go into all the gruesome details. Would highly recommended watching.
But it went well.
Yeah, it went really well. Yeah, it was actually my shortest hospital stay out of the year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So I was only in for 5 days. Which is amazing. They originally told me 10 to 12 days, but 5 days, and they're really happy. So they kicked me out. They were really pleased. They said it was perfect, which is great.
So your dad was quite proud of that?
My dad was so proud of that.
So this is now we're in January 2020. There's a kind of recovery period. How long was that?
I don't know. How long did I recover?
A month, maybe.
A month. But I felt... Yeah, I immediately felt better because dialysis was quite rubbish for me. And so I immediately felt a million times better. Felt like I could do anything. About a month, I think.
So then we're in February. And then we're in March 2020, which you may all remember, March 2020. I mean, I was just wondering, going into lockdown and COVID, did you have a different perspective on that, given all you'd just gone through?
Yeah, I think... I definitely did, in a way. So because of the transplant, I have to be on immunosuppressants. So straight away, the government were like, you need shield straight away. It sounds really rubbish, and I'm sure it was for a lot of people. But for me personally, because I was healthier than I'd been in over a year, we actually had a really wonderful time. It was hard in other ways, but because of my health, we were so thankful.
And when were you allowed out? So you must have not been allowed to come out for a while.
Yeah, I think they officially told us to sort of stop shielding in April of this year. Is that right?
Yeah, I think
with maybe gaps in between. But yeah.
Okay.
I've been a bit flexible about it.
You've been vaccinated as well.
Been vaccinated, yes. A bit better now, yeah.
I mean, what are some of the big truths of the Bible, would you say, that have been a comfort and that you've clung to through all of this?
Yes. So I think the main truth for me is something that my mum actually said to me when I was in hospital the very first time back in January 2019.
Yeah.
And she said, she turned to me and said, God will use this. And it was such a comfort to me because, when you don't know why this is happening, you don't know what to do or what the future is going to look like, knowing that God will use this and God will use this to make you more like Jesus, that's what the Bible says. It says that, in a book called Romans, it says, God works all things for the good of those who love him. And all things include suffering and hardship and pain.
Yeah.
And I know that through that, I was made more like Jesus, whether that's by being more patient, more loving, more kind. Wherever it was, I know that God was using that experience to make me more like Jesus. And yeah, that's the truth that really, really helped me. I actually had a friend recently who's also had a lot of health issues in the last couple of years. And she said to me really recently, I'd rather experience those things and be more like Jesus than never experience those things and never be more like Jesus. Because it is, it's such a wonderful way that God uses suffering. I think so that's one of the big truths that really helped me when you don't know why, but you know who's in control of it.
Yeah. And you guys, these guys have got Bible verses tattooed on there. Can you see the tattoo?
Yeah. See.
Is that one of your Bible verses, the one you just quoted?
No, it's not. Do you want to explain?
So quite a few bits of key context, I think, probably for these. So we had two Bible readings at our wedding. So one from Ecclesiastes 9 and one from Revelation 21. And these were actually, we decided on them before Siobhan got sick.
Yeah.
And Ecclesiastes 9, I'd be amazingly impressed if anyone could tell me what it says. But the premise of it is we are all going to die. There is no one who can escape it. Do what you can in this life, but life is unfair. The exact verse I got is, "The race is not to the swift, nor battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, but time and chance happen to all." Mm-hmm. Which is just, it is just, that is just life, isn't it? But on Siobhan's wrist, we had the other reading, which is Revelation 21, verse 4, which speaks of heaven and a reality after death where there will be no more crying and no more pain. I think I probably got the Ecclesiastes verse because I'm the more cynical one in the relationship. But the reason we got them, which I think you're alluding to, was...
it was on your honeymoon.
Well, for our honeymoon, we went to the Greek island of Zakynthos, otherwise known as Zante. And I feel you're not much of a Brit if you go to Zante and don't come out with at least one tattoo. So on the final day, we strolled down the road and got them. It was nearly terrible though, actually, because when we got them, I sent a picture to my mum, wonderful mother, and look at this. And she replied saying, "What are you doing? You know Siobhan's vulnerable to diseases and things like that. Why are you getting a tattoo in Zante?" And I thought, "Mum, it'll be fine. Obviously, the week after, we're in A&E, and Siobhan's unconscious. I'm, a mess, panicking. And they're doing all their A&E questions, and they're saying, "Has she been taking drugs? No. Has she been drinking? No. Has she hit her head? No. Has she had any tattoos recently?"
"Have you had any tattoos recently?"
And I thought, oh, no. I'm pretty sure it's her kidney failure, but what if it is the tattoo?
Thinking, the mothers are going to kill me.
Yeah, I thought, it won't just be Siobhan on hospital bed by the end of the day if it is, goodness me. But thankfully, they quickly ruled out the tattoos. So we got.
I should say, by the way, if you don't normally come to church, this is not a weird thing that every Christian does. I'm quite normal over here without my tattoos, all right? So it's not compulsory. But what would you say? I would just imagine someone here might be thinking, I mean, seems to have worked out all right for them. Would they still be trusting God if it hadn't worked out so well?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked that question a few times, and I think it's a perfectly fair question. And I think I want to say, well, I can't say for certain that if Siobhan had passed away, that I would be sitting here confident in my faith. However, I think I would be. And I think the reason I would be is because my faith is not just something I believe in to make me feel better. I think that's what a lot of people assume. It's not just that Christianity comforts me and that's why I'm a Christian. But I'm a Christian because I think it is objectively true. I think it is just true that 2,000 years ago, God came to earth as a man and suffered and died. And that is incredibly comforting. But I'm not a Christian because it's something nice to believe in. I'm a Christian because I think it is true. I'm convinced that it is true.
Yeah. Siobhan, one final question before we finish. What would you say to someone who's maybe here or tuning in who's really going through something grim, struggling to think of the thought of a good God in that? What would you say to them?
I think we'd both say try reading the Bible and looking at the God of the Bible, because I think you'll come to find that throughout the whole story of the Bible, God is consistently good and God is consistently loving to his people. He shows steadfast love and forgiveness to those who love him and mercy to those who follow him. And yeah, I think I can't boil this down into one sentence, but really do recommend, reading a gospel through, seeing the person of Jesus and who he is. I think you'll see that God is a good God, and he loves us. He loves us all.
Well, Siobhan and Leah, we're really grateful. I mean, it's very intense stuff for you to talk about, and you've been really honest and open. Thank you for coming to speak to us tonight. So we say thank you to Siobhan and Leah. will make us a start again there. We're going to be reading through one man's story this week. It's from the book of Job, and I'm going to read Job chapter 1. It's going to come up on the screen. You can follow along. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite the other 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? That there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabians fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house. And it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. If God is so good, why is the world often so rubbish? It's an age-old philosophical question. It's a personal question, and I'm really sorry if this year it's a question that's been more personal and raw than ever for you or your family. Why, we ask. Why us? For some, this question just immediately torpedoes the integrity of the Christian faith. And our aim this week is not to give neat answers that will take the pain away, as if we could. But the Bible speaks powerfully into human suffering. And it does it usually not so much by theological or philosophical argument, but by telling stories, true stories, that as we stand back and watch those stories unfold, leave us asking, well, what kind of God is this revealing? This week we're going to track one man's story. So allow me to introduce one of the true greats. Sentence one, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright. That doesn't mean that he was perfect, but it does mean he was one who feared God and turned away from evil. Great family man, verse 2, made sacrifices for his kids, literally in verse 5. And a great businessman as well. Do you see all that he has in verse 3? Wealth back then measured not so much by bank balance, but head of livestock. And at the end of verse 3, Time magazine seemed to have named Job as their person of the year because he's the greatest, it says, of all the people of the East. Is it still true in Britain that we don't take to people who are so successful in any particular walk of life, unseemly to be doing quite so well? Must be a skeleton in Job's closet. No. Well, at least he must have become conceited, surely, the self-made man. Some of you may be familiar with Abraham Lincoln's proclamation rebuking his nation. He said, "We've grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown, but we've forgotten God." Job hadn't. Men wanted to be him. Children wanted to be fathered by him. Even the camels seemed to have wanted his name stamped on their backsides. I belong to Job the Great. But one day, there was a man called Roy Sullivan in the 20th century. He was struck by lightning on 7 different occasions and survived them all. The Guinness Book says that's some kind of world record. Job metaphorically hit 4 times inside a minute. Have you had many of those horrible phone calls in your life yet? The pace of the shocks here is just head-spinning. So donkeys and donkeys' servants attacked, destroyed. Sheep servants next, literally struck by something from the sky. Next, it's the camels gone. Another raid. Happens sometimes in business, doesn't it? Dramatic stories of riches to rags. At least you've got your family to go home to, though. Verse 18. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead." You might remember the Manchester Arena attacks. I remember reading about a woman who went into a coma after the attacks. She was in it for weeks, and then virtually the first thing they had to tell her when she woke up, her 8-year-old daughter had died. 10 children here wiped out in a moment. How do you even begin to come to terms? We'll come back to Job's personal tragedy. But it's important to know that it's not just his life that's coming crashing down here. It's an entire way of seeing the world that is apparently crumbling. It's certainly not Hollywood's way of seeing the world, is it? This doesn't happen to the hero. Goes against the grain of most morality and religions. And crucially, isn't this wrong by the very framework that God has established in the Bible? So check this sentence out from Proverbs. "The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous." Do you hear what that's saying? So if there is suffering in a world where God is good, surely that means that suffering is a kind of punishment on the bad people, right? Well, come with me for a peek behind the curtain of the universe. See, Job's story, is actually part of a bigger story. This is our second point. It's like we've shifted from street view outside Job's house to Google Earth, and we're zooming up through the clouds, and then the globe becomes just a tiny thing. Even that disappears as we keep zooming and zooming, and where are we? Well, it's a place where there are angels. There's a Satan. Are we in God's throne room? Rewind just to before Job's life unravels, verse 7. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." Now, if this all sounds very weird, the Jesus of history who we meet in the Gospels affirms that Satan is real. And actually, if you believe in wickedness in the world, well, you're already not that far off believing in him yourself. This glimpse behind the curtain probably raises more questions than it answers. But one thing is abundantly clear. God is in control. See, one of the possible explanations for the if God, why evil question says, actually, maybe God's not so much in control after all. Maybe it's that he sees and cares and wants to help, but his hands are somehow tied. You can see why people might want to go there. Maybe makes God seem less offensive, but it's not true from the evidence here. God sets the limits on Satan. Satan is clearly a dangerous dog here, but he's on God's leash, verse 12. Actually, perhaps uncomfortably, God is the one who kind of initiates the whole conversation. Verse 8, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him?" But Satan is a skeptic. Verse 9, Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side?" Verse 11, "But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. He will curse you to your face." See what he's saying? Easy to nod towards God when you live a charmed life, but whip it all away, and you won't be finding Job in church singing "All Things Bright and Beautiful." Fair point. Is any of us a true worshiper? Or are we all just in it with God for the stuff? And so God gives permission, a terrible permission, for Satan to test Job's faith. Now, it's important to say we cannot extrapolate from this and say every time tragedy strikes, it means that this precise conversation has preceded it, in the case of Siobhan's illness. Or about all of us this year, you know, hit them with a global pandemic, see if they'll worship you. We can't say that that kind of conversation has happened. But us Christians in the room need to be honest about our God and what we believe about him. We mustn't try to get him off the hook on this question of evil by saying God is just trapped in the journey of pain with us. No, God can intervene to end any suffering at any moment, but sometimes chooses not to. He could refuse this terrible permission, but he chooses not to. And so the question then becomes, does God have a good reason? We get something of God's reason for allowing this here. Jesus speaks of other reasons. But this peek behind the curtain tells us that Job's tragedy is part of a bigger story. And so are all of our griefs. That's not at all to say that your personal story doesn't matter, but it does suggest that my happiness right now is not the biggest story I could be part of. Could you bring yourself to trust this God when you can't yet see the purpose in your pain? That's actually the big issue we're going to be thinking about this week. It's the big issue for your exploration of Christianity. Can you trust him? That's our final point. I was at a funeral recently of an old family friend. Douglas had been in the Boys Brigade, and so we sang the Boys Brigade anthem. Any old BBs in the room? I don't know if you know. Oh, there's one. You could give us the karaoke version on the way out the door. I'd never heard the BB anthem before. One verse goes like this. Will your anchor hold in the storms of life when the clouds unfold their wings of strife? When the strong tides lift and the cables strain, will your anchor drift or firm remain? Great questions. Can I ask you, are you anchored in anything that will prove solid when the storm comes? In your darkest moments of this past year, what were you clinging to, I wonder, when control over your life, life itself even, felt more fragile than ever? Job, will your anchor hold? Watch this broken man just after he's told about his children. Verse 20, Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He hasn't kind of unhealthily detached himself emotionally here, tearing his robe, shaving his head. Those are the signs of deep mourning. But no presumption about his entitlements. Naked I came, naked I'll go. No demands about what God can or can't do. No accusation against God at all. The sufferer here is the one making it clear to us that, well, is God evil? Is that the answer? No, that's definitely not the answer on the question of the existence of suffering and evil. And actually, it's the same in the next chapter, after Satan destroys his health. And in terms of the tension of this 42-chapter story, that's basically it. Satan was wrong. Job didn't only worship for the stuff. God was vindicated. The end. It's much messier in the detail. 40 chapters of messiness as Job cries and wavers and wrestles with God. Of course he does. He was a real person. But this prayer at the end is Job's cry from his heart and at his best. The great man of the East, they called him. Surely this was his greatest hour. Can I ask you, will your anchor hold on your darkest day? What is your anchor? I think it's so inspiring when you hear stories of Christian believers whose faith has been tested and whose faith has shone. Thanks again, Siobhan and Leo. Satan must hate that kind of thing. Because if the best of times can't drive you away from being a worshiper, and if the worst of times can't drive you away from being a worshiper, then in a sense, you're kind of untouchable to the devil's schemes. Job is not the perfect role model as the story unfolds, but in so many ways, he shadows and points us to the perfect sufferer. This is a famous Salvador Dali. It's in a gallery up in Glasgow. I remember seeing it there as a small child. Most depictions of the cross look upwards or side on to Jesus from the human angle. Dali deliberately focuses us down onto the scene as if it's a God's eye view. Could it be that there's a God's eye perspective and purpose in allowing suffering and evil, even the evil of his own son's naked murder? Well, that's the kind of thing you need to believe if you're going to join in with Job's prayer here. Job's challenge is, can you pray this? What would you need to believe about God to mean this? Easy to presume a lot in terms of blessings we feel entitled to, explanations that we feel we're owed. Job knows nothing here of the conversation we heard from behind the curtain. Of course, he will ask the why questions as we do. And I feel very aware that for some of us, this is stuff that's really raw. But Job's worldview that he recommends to us is one of trust in a Lord in heaven who he personally knows. I wonder, what would you need to believe about God to pray this? The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
Well, thank you all so very much. And Leo and Siobhan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We got some questions coming in here already. If God knows everything, then why did he have to go through this whole exercise? You know, why couldn't he have just been done with the exercise? If he knew that Job was going to stand at the end of it anyway, is the question.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's a really good question, and you're right to assume that God does know everything, and so God was not going, oh, I wonder what's going to happen here and how this is going to work out. What that tells us is for God's trying to teach everyone else something through this, actually. So something to Job, something to Satan, something to us, because this has been put in the Bible for our benefit. So the lesson that it teaches that wider audience is, now actually, look, God is vindicated. Actually, God is worthy of worship for who God is. It's not dependent on all the stuff that he's given you. Job's faith is vindicated in that way, as being a person of trust. And Satan, if you like, to the world audience reading in and watching in, is proved to be wrong. So God uses this to prove to Satan and to the rest of us, look, he may be prowling around. It uses that language in the New Testament. He's prowling around here in verse 7. And God is making the point that, no, actually, the tested genuineness of believing faith actually proves believers to be genuine, proves God to be worthy of worship, and shows Satan that he won't win. So it's a lesson to the rest of us.
Thanks so much, Kev. If the whole thing is there to prove God's victory, then if I was Job, you know, I'd be mad for the death of my whole family. So
yeah.
how do you deal with that whole issue? Because it seems that all this wretchedness has happened just to prove a point.
Yeah. And I think part of the answer to that one is, I hope you'll come back. And I don't know whether you'll be able to come back to the building or even to watch this at the same slot every night. But this is an unfolding story. And in two nights' time, we're going to really focus in on Job's emotional response. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Thanks for saying he's mad. You'll see that he is mad. There's real anger there. There's a real groaning. There's a real complaint to God in all of this. And yet Job leans in towards God, always as the one who he's trusting. And I think it's important to say, and the reason I wanted to get to Jesus at the end there is, this is not just some big game with God. We're not just pawns and pieces. And we know a lot more than Job. It was amazing trust that he demonstrated. And as we look at Jesus Christ, God sending his own son, we can see that, well, in this example of Job, that's one example in a world that God is working out purposes in, God has kind of, you might say, skin in the game himself. It's not a very good phrase because it's not a game. God is personally invested in the suffering and the resolution of it. So that's important for us to factor in as we think about our response.
Yeah, that's really helpful. How would you answer that, Leo?
I think at the core, we worship a God who knows what it's like to suffer. Just like Kev said, it's not as if this is a distant, far off, ambivalent party who's just moving the pieces of the world. But as Kev said, it is a God who, you know, we genuinely believe from history, came to earth 2,000 years ago, was described as a man of sorrows, for his life was so hard, and suffered really more than any of us have, certainly far more than we have. And I think that's what encourages us at the end of the day. Just looking at the core of Christianity is Jesus. And Jesus knows exactly what it's like to suffer.
That's really, really helpful. Kev, what's the reason that God doesn't just remove Satan from the cycle of time? You know, because if there really is a good God and an evil Satan, And why doesn't God just obliterate Satan?
Yeah, and, you know, we need to, you know, I need to say, I don't know a lot, I hope, this week, because one of the big purposes of the book of Job is to say, look, can you trust God even when you don't know all the answers to these things? So how do I know, in that sense, why God doesn't obliterate Satan? What we can say is that God is in control of Satan. This is not a big good versus evil kind of dualism, you know, with God in the blue corner and Satan in the red corner. I wonder who's going to win. But what we can see very clearly as the Bible story unfolds is that in God's defeat of Satan, as he shows himself to be more powerful than Satan's lies and destruction, that is one of the ways that God shows his own greatness to all of us. It's one of the ways that he builds trust in his people. And actually, the amazing thing that you see again and again in the Bible, God is so great that he's able to actually work through. It's not just that he overcomes the obstacles that the enemy puts in his way. Again and again, God actually works through the bad things that happens to achieve a greater purpose. And so that strengthens our faith as we see him able to work in that way.
Thank you very much indeed. I mean, how would you say to somebody demonstrably that Satan is defeated, that God is kind of stronger than Satan, that it's not a kind of two equal opponents in opposite sides of the ring? There's a question along those lines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from this passage, the way you see it is, you know, you see the way that Satan has to ask God's permission to do anything to Job. He's like a dangerous dog, is how you would cut. You know, he's allowed to go so far, but he's not allowed to go any further than God permits. That's absolutely clear in the book of Job. And then come right forward to Jesus. And I'd love you, you know, what you see in Jesus is exactly the same pattern on all of these things. You see that he is in control. You see that he does really care. You see his victory over the evil one in Jesus' own ministry, as again and again, the strongholds of the devil are cast out of people's lives. And then the ultimate place where that is demonstrated is at the cross itself, which the Bible describes as the great defeat of Satan, as all of the punishment for all of the wrong of the whole world is dealt with by Jesus at the cross. Jesus says, I saw Satan fall from heaven. Now, Jesus is clear that in his ministry, the ministry of Satan is defeated.
Mm. I mean, one of the great things about Christianity Explored, which is round the tables at the back there, is it looks at Mark's gospel and Jesus's life and action with regards to evil in Mark, which is just categorically the case that Jesus is stronger than the evil one.
I know, and the reason that it's so good to go in that course is because you're probably already thinking, hey, they're talking as if the devil's real, they're talking about Jesus casting out demons. Wait a minute, you know, I've got about 300 questions just about those things. It's a real chance to get into discussing what all of that means.
That's really helpful. Well, I'm glad you got the microphone now, Siobhan. I wanted to ask both of you, really, were there moments, I sort of think there must have been moments, were there moments where you were kind of beset with doubts and that sort of thing in terms of the goodness of God, or were you just very strong throughout?
Yeah, and look, I can't. Yeah, please. I really hope we've not given the impression that we are superheroes who went into this smiling and smiled the whole way through. Mm-hmm. There were many nights, and to be honest, I think there still are, which are really hard. And I remember genuine anger towards God, genuine tears from both of us about what was going on. Please don't think we are perfect in that way. But I just think all of those truths that we've been talking about tonight, they are what we needed. And as Kev said in the talk, you know, we're still human, as Job was a human. But to know that God's works all things for the good of those who love him, as Siobhan said. Well, that's the truth that it might not necessarily stop the pain like that. But actually, when you look back in hindsight at the past few years or whatever, it's amazingly comforting. It's not as if our grief was wasted. It's not as if the past few years of our life have been pathetic, you know, on this trajectory of us and our massive wins and successes. but actually God has used that suffering. Yeah. Tiona, I don't think.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that, yeah, there was real times where, I think because, yeah, as Kev was saying in the talk, there often isn't an answer as to why. We don't know that God's having this conversation for our particular situation. But what we do know is that God is sovereign. God has shown that in the Bible. And yeah, every time I would think, why is this happening? I would be reminded of those truths in the Bible, and the truths of God working for the good of those who love him, God creating the world and being sovereign over it. And yeah, creating us, creating people, and knowing that if God has control over those things, he definitely has control over my situation. Yeah, and I also want to say that, like, we're very aware that people have been through far worse things in their lives than we have. We're very privileged to have a very comfortable life, realistically. And I think, yeah, the real truth of the gospel in those really dark days helped us go on. Yeah.
That's so helpful. Thank you for being so honest. I've got another question I'm wanting to ask you in just a moment. But before we get there, why does evil not only exist, but persist if God is in control, Kev?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really big question. And I mean, we're definitely in the level of kind of divine mystery when we're thinking about why evil exists. We don't know all the answers on this. We know that Satan doesn't have some kind of independent existence other than being created by God. Now, it's important to say, as soon as we say that, God does not create evil. So the Bible always, God is always at arm's length. God allows a world where evil exists, clearly, but God does not kind of say, let's wind this thing up and it be evil, either with Satan or with human beings. So God is at arm's length from evil in that way. Why does it persist? I don't know. That's actually one of the big groans of the Bible. Come, Lord Jesus, is the final prayer at the end of the Bible, because we long that evil won't persist. Actually, the more you believe about God and the fact that he's made promises, the more you pray that kind of prayer, because you think, well, why the delay? One of the reasons for the delay is because if God was going to end evil, what would God have to end? Well, he'd have to end a broken world. He'd have to end people that do harm to each other. He'd have to end us, basically, and end the world. And that is what God promises to do, to remake the world with a new kind of people in a new kind of body, in a new kind of world. He delays to give more people time to hear that Jesus is the answer to our failure and our problems. But why does evil persist? Yet why? And God's perspective on that delay, we live in the middle of the story. And it's just really hard when you live in the middle of the story.
Thank you very much. Now, I want to come back to, we've just got time for a couple more questions. So I want to come back to both of you. And I mean, Siobhan, I was just amazed at what sounded like people queuing up to give you their kidneys. I think it's absolutely staggering. And you said some of them were your Christian friends and that sort of thing. That's obviously one benefit of having Christian friends. But can you tell us some of the other benefits that you made you thankful for being Christian? You talked a lot about the way you think about things, mm-hmm. and kind of make sense of life and so forth, and things that were really helpful. But were there other practical realities that being in a Christian group, as it were beneficial?
Yeah, there were so many practical things that helped us so much. And I can't even explain how many ways. People driving us to and from church when I couldn't really go anywhere. People picking us up from the hospital really late at night, missing out on things so they could come and collect us. People cooking Leo dinner every night when I was in the hospital. All of this church family, coming together to help us when we needed it the most. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, one of the most awfully sad things I think we came across was it was kind of I'll keep it all very anonymous, obviously, but a group of young people who have kidney failure that Siobhan was involved in. It's not a Christian group at all. And someone posted on Facebook once and said, did anyone lose all of their friends when they got kidney failure? And people said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, my friends and I were friends because we used to go out drinking together, and that's just what we did all the time. And now I have kidney failure, I can't do that, and I've lost all of my friends. And that just, it just struck me so much, and just made me, it made us so thankful that, you know, we have people we'd call brothers and sisters, Christian brothers and sisters in our church, who, you know, we think are really with us through thick and thin. And you're a bad friend when you're sick as well. We were, you know, terrible friends for a whole year. We couldn't serve anyone. We couldn't give anyone anything, really. We were absolute takers. But to have people who would just completely get on board with that, we were hugely thankful for.
Yeah. Well, no, look, we've got one more question I want to ask you, Kev. There are other questions, and I'm really sorry we haven't had time to answer all of them. But do come back, by the way. Come back. Join us tomorrow evening. If you can't make it into the building, join us online. It is an unfolding story, isn't it? The story of Job. I'm really looking forward to being here next tomorrow night and Thursday and Sunday. Is this Christian God really a firm anchor if we can't really be sure that Jesus is God? That's for you, Kev.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's... Read you John's Gospel. I see that there's John's Gospel dotted around the place. That is the big question that John has written that gospel to enable us to engage with. Read it as you watch him jump off the page, as you hear the things he says. Do you think he's God? Mm. Have a read of it and maybe chat to the friend that brought you about it. Mm.
And the John's Gospel is actually written for that purpose, isn't that right?
That's right.
Right. That we may believe that Jesus is the Christ and that we may have life in his name. It's actually written to persuade us from the eyewitness John, who was there, saw the resurrection, and so forth. Well, what a great start to the week. Thank all three of you, Kev. Thank you so much, and thank you to your church family for letting you loose tonight with us.
Okay.
And Leo and Siobhan, it's just wonderful to hear your story, and thank you for being so ready to share it with us.